Hey everyone, thank you for being here. This is the video specifically for the 1301, Philosophy 1301, Introduction to Philosophy content overview. So let's go ahead and start screen sharing. And you should be able to see my screen again. I haven't uploaded, like, by the time you watch these, obviously I'm going to upload them. I'm still making the first one, the fourth one, and the fifth one. So, like I was just saying, all of those are, the first one being like the overview that every class looks at, the two about me's that I made last semester that every class looks at, the workflows that I made just now that every class looks at. And now on this one, we're doing the content overview unique to 1301, which is a main class that I teach. There are other content overviews specific to like 1304, 2305, 2306, 2310. Those are some of the courses I've been told that I may need to teach one day, so I'd like to build those out. So in 1301, I guess I want to look at the course description, the reading schedule, well, the reading list, the reading schedule, and maybe some of the guiding questions. I want to look at what our units are. If you have any questions about like what the assignments are or how to study or where to access and find things, all of that should have been covered comprehensively in the workflows video. And so I encourage you to go back and revisit that to see if you have a question or to reach out to me. I actually prefer if students reach out to me with their questions than, trying to figure it out themselves. I would rather repeat myself than students get frustrated with class. So it's preferable to me to do the extra, to spend the time communicating with you. One, it's a chance to talk to you a little bit, which I don't always get to do. And two, I'm here to help. So really, this is stuff that I wish I would say in the one that all the classes see. Okay, so for 1301, we have 5 units. And in the course description, the first unit is not listed. The first unit in 1301 is called Intuitionism. And we only read one text. And my idea here is that we focus on this one text for extra time together. And so I really make sure you understand everything about it. And I get you set up for later in the semester where you have to do that on your own with a different text in a shorter amount of time. So by the second unit on ancient philosophy, we're covering more philosophers in a quicker at a quicker pace. And you're only going to choose one primary source to do the essay on. But you won't know what the prompts are specifically until you get into the exam, all that stuff. So, intuitionism is our first unit. Our second unit is ancient philosophy. Our third unit is modern philosophy. The dates for these are part of your syllabus quiz. So, what may be surprising is that modern philosophy goes, in our case, from 1641 to basically 1800. But I include John Stuart Mill's utilitarianism in that unit because I don't have a necessarily better place to put it. It is almost pragmatic. It's proto-pragmatic, so it almost goes in American pragmatism, but he wasn't American, he was British. And So then unit 4 is American pragmatism, and unit 5 is continental philosophy. They're mostly in chronological order. It's just that I think that Bergson is a fun piece to start with. I also think that the method that Bergson introduces using intuition instead of analysis is important for philosophizing because we're not just connecting dots and like linking up words. We have to feel and understand the truth of something. And that's a skill that you learn. It's called eidetics. In phenomenology down here in continental philosophy, eidetic noetic intuition becomes fairly prominent. And yeah. I want to keep this kind of light and quick just because, at 60 hours on the continent itself, there's plenty to say for everything, and I've already said a lot of it for 1301 at least. There are some older videos on YouTube, like I said before, that are unlisted for 1301 syllabus, and that has some content overviews on it, but it also has some design overviews that aren't cogent or consistent anymore. And so I, really don't want somebody to see that design and go, man, I wish we were doing that class. Because, like, the things I cut, I had to cut because I couldn't afford to grade them, or I didn't think they were useful, or they weren't working just in a balanced way like I needed them to. So the design had to change, and I, this is what we're doing. But so we'll spend 2 weeks on intuitionism, 2 weeks on ancient philosophy, 3 weeks on modern philosophy, 4 weeks on American pragmatism, and I believe 3 weeks on continental philosophy. 3 weeks on continental philosophy. Not including the final, though. So with continental, we get an extra week for the final. So it's really more like 4 weeks for continental, 4 weeks for American pragmatism. And then ancient and modern are these like kind of shotgun surveys that move really fast through a lot of material. And we switch up. And that's probably what's more confusing for students is that we switch up. So in American pragmatism in Unit 4 and in Unit 5 with continental philosophy, we have one text that we address for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. Same with intuitionism. But Units 2 and 3 just have more of a survey to them, so they can be a lot to try to wrangle or manage. As long as you understand, though, that I want you to follow the lectures for all of them. I want you to try to read through all of them at least once and listen to them at least once, because I'll read them. I do read them to you. But you should be prepared to write an essay on one of them. You only write an essay on one of them, but have like that second one as a backup, right? In case that first prompt isn't what you thought it would be. Okay. Never hurts to say it too many times. So this first week we're doing, syllabus, icebreakers, and practicing respondus. Those are the three assignments, and you should watch the five videos. This syllabus is not correct. That should say five. Let me see if I can change this real quick, because I thought I had fixed that. Maybe I didn't fix both parts of it. It should be okay, that one's right. So I haven't pushed the new syllabus yet. The one that's saved under PDFs, if I open it right now, so this is when I publish my new site, I have to manually push updates to the site. And this one has the correct HTA episodes. So this first week, you should also do that. Everything's due Sunday if you're online. If you're in person, the exit ticket would be due physically to me on the last day of class that week, at the end of class. And the syllabus quiz and the respondus would be done online. We may not do respondus if we're doing tests in person. Obviously, we wouldn't. So then you wouldn't have that component. Okay. But that's not a reason to scrap the whole video or the other videos. Still looks right. So intuitionism, 2 weeks cover in my teacher copy, it's 36 pages, and in your copy, it's 50 pages in the blank copy. So, but we pick up the pace throughout the semester. That may seem like a lot, but we have that for three lessons, 1.5 weeks, and then the end of the second week is the exam. Dedicate half a week to that. And in all the units, we dedicate half a week to an exam. It's a lesson on the final week of the unit. The only exception, and I apologize for this, is Unit 2. There's not a good place to cut a third lesson on Unit 2, even though there's a lot of hours in this first week. If I made this mandatory, I guess I could add it. But then my other problem is that we push unit three over spring break, and I don't want to like finish a unit at the after a break because I'm worried that students will have a harder time remembering everything they've learned. And obviously I want you to remember it or learn it well enough that it sticks with you no matter what. But yeah. Anyway, so you do have, but lesson one this week is only two episodes on that week where you have the exam and two lessons. And then every other exam, you only have one lesson that week. So like for the first exam, you're finishing up the only reading for that unit. For the second exam, for that week of the exam, it's 2 weeks. And for that week of the exam, you're doing maybe like 20 pages in Plato. I think it's like two, I literally think it's only like 2 hours of lecture. So let's look. It's this one right here. So videos. Yeah. An hour and 57 minutes. No, an hour and 58 and a half minutes. 58 minutes and 19 seconds. 1 hour, 58 minutes and 19 seconds for those two videos. So it's a really short front week. And then, you have the ex and then you have Aristotle, which is a little bit longer. Those episodes I think are that might be like 3.5 or 4 hours total. And then you'll have the exam. So again, you should expect in all my classes, 6 to 9 hours of reading and thinking and reading, but it's cool stuff. It's in the Apology we learn that Socrates argues that it's the best way to spend your time, and Aristotle will argue that too. So that's one of our big themes in the ancient philosophy section. Whereas in intuitionism, we're making a big distinction between intuition and analysis. Intuition is a felt connection to ourselves and others. Analysis is partial assemblages of like connecting discrete viewpoints. There's a lot to say about it. You'll just have to watch the videos. But in unit two, we're looking at ancient philosophy about four negative or sorry, not negative, 400 BCE to 350 BCE, about a 49, 50-year period. Intuitionism is 1903. It's the original text. And then, the books that I read it in, I don't have the years here. They are in the Guiding Questions. So The Creative Mind, the most recent version, was published in 2007. It was originally published, I guess, in 1946. But Introduction to Metaphysics was originally 1903. The essay itself was published on its own, and then it was included in Creative Mind when it was published as a book 43 years later. Okay. Anyway, that's relevant. So other than that 1903 kind of jump start, the other units are in order, which means that's one of your questions on your syllabus quiz is to put the units in order. So negative or sorry, 400 BCE before Common Era to 350 BC. It's technically 399, I guess, is when the Apology happened. The Republic, I think, was like 370s or something. And Nicomachean Ethics was 350, circa 350. There's lots to say about all these philosophers. Like Plato was Aristotle's teacher. Socrates never really taught Plato. Plato followed him around. And then Plato uses Socrates as a mouthpiece. Bergson's incorporating responses to a lot of people in the history of philosophy. He has things to say about the ancients and the moderns, but we don't spend too much time on that in the videos, and it's not part of the essay prompt. Let's see. And then, yeah, Aristotle was Plato's teacher. They differ from each other, they kind of respond to each other. And then, 2000 years later, 1641, Descartes writes Meditations on First, or tries to publish or spread around Meditations on First Philosophy. I forget all the specifics. I mean, he sent it to some colleagues and got feedback from them at first, and I would think that was before 41. I'm not sure exactly. We'll do that for a week. So we have 3 weeks in modern philosophy, and that comes before spring break. You know, in a future semester, the spring break might be different. Or Thanksgiving break if it's a fall semester, or if it's like a fall break, whatever we call it, right? The week that we usually have 1 full week off, and it seems like all of my classes. So that'll move around, or we lose like, anyway, just for your specific semester, look at the new dates, look at the new sequencing. I try to make it intuitive and not put a break in the middle of a unit. But for example, in 1304 this semester, spring 2026, we do have spring break in the middle of the second unit. So, so modern philosophy goes, like I said, from 1641 to 1800. Mill is 1853, I think, utilitarianism. And the three big ethical theories in the history of philosophy, like normative ethics, are virtue ethics, primarily out of Aristotle, but influenced strongly by Plato. So virtue, Aristotelian virtue ethics. Pretty classic focus on character and wisdom and context and the mean. And then Kant's grounding for the metaphysics of morals and deontology in general looks at universal law and what is a priori or necessarily true in and of itself about a good will or about doing the right thing or ethics. And consequentialism or utilitarianism, trying to maximize the utility of the outcome of an action, or picking behaviors that on average, or rules that on average produce healthy actions, like never steal, never kill, never lie. There's a distinction between somebody who wants to maximize the local pleasure, I mean the local unique to that act. It's never local. Well, it's always considered across a population that may differ. And so who deserves personhood in the calculations of utilitarianism? Another question. Anyway, there are lecture series devoted to each of these topics because I think that they're important. I hope I'm not too much of a bummer when it comes to utilitarianism because I don't think you can calculate things like that. But I appreciate it as a foil to cover all the bases and then point out like why it has issues and why the other theories do its task better. I think I like virtue ethics the best, although I used to like deontology the best. But we also in the modern period, we also are studying, like I said, the Meditations on First Philosophy for the first week. And then there's a series kind of spread out with a few different readings. Spinoza should be listed here as well, but there's part three of Spinoza included in the reading list. It's up here in, well, I guess we could here. I'll keep going through the individual readings and then we'll pop back up and do the course description. But in the individual, but in the reading list, you can see there's a short, like 5 or 7 page excerpt from part three that's at the beginning of it that I think is really helpful and goes with Brian Mitsumi's Politics of Affect. All of these are provided to my students for free as excerpts or, you know, full text PDFs. You don't need to buy the book. If you do buy the book, if you like having a print copy and you can afford it, I would always encourage that. But I don't think that if you don't have it, you don't have it. So, so that was Mitsumi. So we'll spend a week on Descartes, Meditations on First Philosophy, and that'll kind of get us into phenomenology too. It'll let us go from a first-person experience of truth, excuse me, uncertainty, to the experience of God in Descartes, and then the experience of God as nature in Spinoza, But kind of also more focused on affect theory in Mitsumi and in causation in Spinoza. So for Spinoza, God is everything. Mind and matter are the same thing, two different ways of looking at God. The entire universe is not always conscious in the same sense that we're conscious. But Spinoza says something like, every action or every effect has adequate and inadequate causes. I am sometimes the adequate cause of my actions, and I am sometimes the inadequate cause. When I am the inadequate cause, God is the adequate cause of my action. Insofar as something outside of me, some other place, some other person or influence or affect or desire or punishment or weakening or strengthening or lesson or whatever, is the reason why I do what I do. That adequate cause is still God, just like I am partaking of God. So whether I am the adequate cause or the inadequate cause, God is always the adequate cause of everything and is everywhere because God is everything and everywhere. But that's mostly God is part one of the ethics, and we're doing part three, which is more about causation and human emotion or affection. So emotion is kind of like our subjective registering of the conscious experience of affecting and being affected by mind, matter, or God. Anyway, that's Mitsumi and Spinoza. It should make more sense after Descartes. Descartes is the one who kind of classically says we can doubt everything, but I think therefore I am, cogito ergo sum. But for Descartes, thinking includes having sensory perceptions, which you can put a container on that, but we don't. The way that I present the reading, having sensory perceptions is a phenomenological experience. So I can trust that this is a real perception of this. I don't need to know that it exists, or I don't know that it exists on its own, or that God would keep it going after I die, or that my soul can leave my body, which are things that Descartes wants to prove. But in the first three meditations, specifically in the first two meditations, by the end of the second meditation, I think, therefore I am. And thinking includes a lot of things. Basically, any conscious experience is going to be mental, and the things that I think are out there on the wall behind me, so to speak, or far away, that I perceive in some distant land, are actually part of mind. And the solipsist gets stuck thinking it's their own mind, but both Spinoza and then phenomenologists like Sartre later help us understand that that relation between consciousness and the world or self and world is not strictly speaking separate. And that's where phenomenology comes in and just pops off, and it gets really cool. It goes hand in hand with intuitionism. It works us over to Nancy's fundamental ontology and being singular plural, which I haven't recorded yet, so that'll be a new one for me. It's only about 20 pages, and it's, it is what it is. So it's pretty straightforward to read and think about, but probably 2 hours worth, maybe. And then this one's only an hour. But anyway, let's go back to that's pretty much everything in the modern period. Descartes. In the third meditation, we'll talk about the arguments for God's existence, as well as the Cartesian circle, clear and distinct perceptions, and henosis as partaking of God's divinity as a way of knowing. And those are all responses to the Cartesian circle. So there's a lot there. The Descartes readings are short, but there's just a lot to think about and talk about. The Kant reading is really short and answered the question, what is enlightenment? Kant is basically saying that you should trust your own reason and have courage to fail, and you'll learn quick enough. He does some other things in there, like public versus private reason, and he also says that it's a crime against nature, human nature, to set down a set of laws that no group of humans can ever argue against or seek to change. So all religious beliefs and all civil laws, and he lived in a he had a king in Prussia when he wrote this, Kant. All of those things are need to be up for debate, and that's where private reason comes into play, or public reason comes into play. Private reason and public reason are easily confused, but private is not what you write when you're alone in private. Private is public is what you write to the world when you're alone in private. But private reason is what you do in the context of a local community. So if I lead a local past group of clergy, if I'm a clergyman and I lead a flock of church members or synagogue members or mosque members, or I'm a teacher, which I am. Kant argues that there are certain rules that you should follow if you're given directions, but that you should always be free to argue against those to the public at large, open. And so public just means open, and private is closed. It has a more narrow set of audience members. It's just the congregation, or it's just the students in that specific class. I often try to make my teaching open, in fact, instead of losing voice to a specific target audience. Okay. Unit 4, James is the first week. I really think James could be half of a week. I could have probably tried to either make Dewey, the first chapter of Dewey, its own week. Which I actually think, if hopefully you're paying attention to this, I think that you should maybe do that. So it's not going to be unlocked. You won't be able to do the icebreakers yet or the exit tickets yet. But after you finish up on James in week one of American Pragmatism, I suggest you try to hop in to Dewey's Artist Experience. In my opinion, it's longer, but it's only 6 hours. It's like 3 or 4 hours for James and 6 hours for Dewey. But I think, James is only 15 or 20 pages, whereas Dewey is 60 pages, three chapters, way more complicated in my experience, from my perspective. I think James has two or three main points that he really focuses on in what pragmatism means. It's a very easy text. And Dewey just kind of throws it all at you from the beginning and then keeps complexifying it and tying those ideas together. There's a lot more material to work with for the essay exam if you choose Dewey instead of James. James is just a more straightforward example. But in both cases, I should have it set up to where you don't have the precise prompt beforehand, but you should be able to use the study guide. There should be a study guide posted for this. The lectures have extensive notes on them. So let's look at, right. So if you go to hillj.net/teaching/phil-1301/all, you'll come to this page. Or you can go to hillj.net, and at the top, you can click teaching. You can click Phil 1301 on the list. And it'll take you to this page where you have all the lectures in order, based on the week they go in, week 11.5. So that's the second part of week 11. And you can see I've got the final James lecture set up for the second part of week 10. But again, start up on this one if you can. And there are these guiding questions in here with some exemplary answers. James also has guiding questions with exemplary answers, but there are actually a few other components to the prompt that are not there, but are, I think, in the final guiding questions things. I mean, I might circle back and try to update that eventually. But quite certain that in the lecture videos, I have the more comprehensive set of prompts and the guiding questions. Yeah. So this is all here in the guiding questions. So there are more guiding questions than are in these lectures because I didn't answer them all, but you can answer them from the lecture. And I tried to make that essay prompt more robust. Anyway, let's get back to the schedule. So you have 60 pages of Dewey. There is a holiday in there, but I didn't really It's a half week. It's only one Friday off. It's an online class, so I didn't make anything of it. You're missing essay exams, or due that week for 30% off. And the next week we have the aesthetic critique. Like I said in the general workflows video, the aesthetic critique, you will take a work of art or an experience of art, and using Dewey's kind of comprehensive understanding of aesthetic experience in everyday life, where like having a family dinner or going to a religious event or going to a sporting event or going to a family reunion, or any of these things can have aesthetic consummation to them. So you'll describe that experience and then explain how it works, and that'll be 5% if you want it. And the next week, you'll take your essay exam and do and turn in your annotations. And remember to turn in your annotations before taking the exam, mainly because that's the order it is on the syllabus quiz. So, all right. I guess I should explain more about this. In artist experience, like I was saying, there are three chapters that we cover. The Live Creature has a critique of museums and presents sort of biological or evolutionary experience as a universal ground common to all living beings, which it is. Things like needing food and needing shelter, needing stability, having strife when we fall out of step, making failures to achieve our goals, making strides to accomplish our goals once we have failed and have learned what we have to do instead. These form the basis for Dewey of turning matter into spirit, which are not separate things. So we'll again address idealism and materialism here, and dualism versus monism. James is a dualist pragmatist, and Dewey is a monistic pragmatist. But Dewey takes these continuums where the two extremes are what you traditionally call the dyad, like matter and spirit, or flesh and soul, or matter and mind, body and mind. And he says that, aesthetic experience is the means by which the live creature can take material things and make of them ethereal things, things greater even than the creator made. I don't think I have the text with me here, but it's a really cool set of chapters. And in the third chapter, Having an Experience, Dewey talks about sort of a different valence to aesthetic experience, which is any kind of consummate experience that has a beginning and an end, a sort of discrete intelligibility. And then he also seeks to explain how you can have overlapping experiences which dovetail into each other or through each other. And so rhythms are a big component here, thinking about how we can integrate diverse rhythms of necessity or responsibility from different areas of our life. Like you might have one rhythm, like I might have, like you all have different rhythms for your different classes. And if you work a job too, that's another rhythm. And if you have family responsibilities, that's another rhythm. Animals, all these schedules, birthdays, sleeping, these are all rhythms. And we can fail at these rhythms, but to be in harmony and have aesthetic experience means to bring all these rhythms together. And there are different ways of talking about this, and Dewey gives us a lot of resources for talking about it. And what pragmatism means, we see that pragmatism is a functional method of flattening debate between two things that don't really differentiate in the real world. So if I have opinion A and you have opinion B, or belief A and belief B, or conviction A and conviction B, but we live exactly the same lives in most regards, where we should expect to find distinctions because of those convictions or beliefs, we can assume that they're not meaningful distinctions in belief or conviction and a waste of breath and energy to argue about them. So we're stripping down unnecessary distinctions that don't mean anything, but we're also finding the function of the meaning, right? The truth of an idea is not only if it represents the world or if it matches up with some ideal reality, but the truth or the meaning of an idea is what it does when somebody believes it. The other thing to note is the genetic theory of truth, where truth is the sort of reciprocal process of adapting words and behaviors onto endeavors of survival. So we use three to talk about three things, because we've associated the word three with what it means for there to be three things. And then if in some cases we tried to use three for two things, that would be inconsistent with our other experiences. A lot of students misunderstand the genetic theory of truth, it seems, as something where different generations come across different versions of truth and like slowly refine the scientific method or science as a whole. And your family passes down their wisdom onto you. And that's not really what the genetic theory of truth is. I mean, from the time we were babies, my truth is different from your truth because I'm using words to adapt to a set of behaviors in response to my first person perspective that means what I think they mean. And we generally have meaningful communication and a lot of overlap. But my truth is fine-tuned between myself and my environment through reciprocal honing. And it's a matter of individual honing, not like the way, like if I'm teaching a group of second graders, the students do not understand two and three at the same time. What I mean by that is if I have five students and I'm trying to get and obviously kindergarten is maybe more where we're talking about fundamental arithmetic and numbers or like basic things like differences in number. This is what you call four things. This is what you call five things. Whatever age group you're doing that, different students will be able to do it at different times because it's a reciprocal fine-tune process. So if you're using AI, I think that's why they misunderstood this. I don't think I was unclear in the lecture when you get to it. But anyway, that's something I saw as a common misunderstanding there. All right. Sartre's sketch for a theory of the motions in Unit 5 on Continental Philosophy. Oh, American pragmatism is like what pragmatism means is 1904. And then Dewey's Art as Experience was published in 1934, 1933. I think it's 1934, but I always say it's 1933. Yeah. So like the syllabus quiz says 33 on it. I gotta go back and change that. It probably says 34 now if I fixed it. Time warp. Asynchronous videos reused multiple semesters. Anyway. Dewey published it in 1934, and I believe it was delivered as the 1931 or 1932 Harvard Williams James Lectures. So James is not the first pragmatist, but Dewey's coming right behind him. Okay. Unit 5, we have Sartre, Nancy, and Deleuze. Sartre's the biggest chunk. Deleuze is only 1 hour, and I haven't recorded Nancy yet, but I think it'll be like 2 hours, maybe. Sartre is 60 pages, but the pages are really small. And the ideas are really easy to follow, probably easier than Sartre. He has a kind of Sartrean method. He uses things that are obviously clear if you follow along. And I mean, if you understand what he's saying, like they make sense. So that's the whole point of eidetics, is that there's a, it's intelligible for the intuition or the intellect to map onto and follow the phrases being formed and feel the truth of what they're saying. Bergson talks about talks about flexible, fuzzy concepts that are adaptable and ready to mold to the fleeting forms of intuition. So that's what I think Sartre does here, is he presents us with a dialectical eidetics that is so universal as to be convincing. And in following his language, we can like kind of map our intuition onto an analysis or language that is obvious to most people, even early philosophers. And that's probably what's happening if you ascribe to Bergson's view of language, is that language can communicate to us what intuition has already come to know without language. This will make more sense when you get to Bergson, but he basically explains that a sketch of the Tower of Notre Dame in Paris will evoke the surrounding cafes if you've been there, but to somebody who's not been there, all the sketches in the world are just sketches. And so you can start to understand the process of building up your own understanding and grasping it for yourself, which is one of the main meanings of eidetic noetic intuition, or what Sartre says is the consciousnesses acts consciousnesses absolute proximity to itself. So the absolute proximity of my consciousness to itself, and the absolute proximity of your consciousness to itself. And this is what the cogito does. I think, therefore, I am. It shows you the identity or the linkage or adumbration or intentionality structure between perception and that which is perceived. And that's back in Plato and Aristotle too, the knower and the known, the perceiver and the good. I try to mention that when we talk about Plato. And then in Aristotle, it's more in Dianema, which I wish we could cover. But if I were to add a week, if I were to cut the pragmatism section at a week one day, one semester, which I may do, I would cover Dianema. I'd rather do that than the sentiment of rationality. But I also might add the sentiment of rationality to American pragmatism. As it stands, I'm already adding non-C to unit five, so I don't think I should try to add either of those like kind of bonus wow lectures into Aristotle's short but really confusing even for me. And James is like 50 pages, but really cool, easy to follow. And then Nancy is 20 pages short and easier to follow than Aristotle. So, in the introduction, like I said, Sartre critiques psychology as being an empirical science that doesn't have that proximity to itself. And then in the first section, I'm not sure if these episode numbers map exactly onto when I cover these things. I cover some other stuff in 14.1 and 14.2, like an overview of the history of phenomenology from the Johns Hopkins Literary Studies or Critical Studies, something. I cite my sources as we go. But in the classic theories, he's critiquing basically the two theories of dualism that I think Sartre is a dualist as well, but I'm not. I don't, you don't have to buy into the dualism necessarily. You can try to see at what moments it's not like you can do the eidetic reduction. You can see if it's necessary to understand all of or to if the validity of Sartre's claims depend on his dualism, or if what is to be grasped and benefited from in their theory could survive in a monistic structure. I think a lot of it can. And so, like Merleau-Ponty, I believe, is a more monistic phenomenologist than Sartre. But Sartre has that like interpersonal dualism where the cogito is intersubjective. There's no distance between everything in my perceptual field and myself. But that really means more that I am my world and I'm pulled out of myself through my world. That's called an exigence. So, a book that needs to be mended, or a shoe that, a book that needs to be read, a shoe that needs to be repaired. An essay needs to be graded, an essay needs to be written, whatever it may be. These are all things that pull you out of yourself. I wake up in the morning every morning and I know that my animals need to be taken care of, my German Shepherd and my cat. These are exigences. They make me get up out of bed at a certain, with a certain frequency, at least. Yeah, anyway, the semester starting is an exigence. Publication deadlines, exigences. For Heidegger, the fact that I will die one day is an exigence. It motivates me in other ways and pulls me out of myself in different ways. And Ed and I talk in this bonus interview, 5.1. Ed and I talk about the way that, you know, his death motivates him and forces him along as a sort of simultaneous edge of life itself. So there's an edge where, you know, these dualisms are actually monisms. And they're on a continuum together. And Foucault, for example, says that the outside is necessary in order to inscribe the inside. So falsity, strictly speaking, determines truthhood. So how can we call it false whenever it's only through experiences of the falsehood that we can see where the interiority of the field or the set of true statements is? And it's just the same with, Spinoza's conception of responsibility and failure. If we're not understanding the causation, the moment that we do understand it, we think we could have done better, but we're actually trying to put responsibility on something where we didn't even perceive it the first time and didn't know how to navigate it properly. Okay. But then Sartre wants to make us responsible for our emotions. So there's a lot of it may seem like conflict, but I like how they work together. So he critiques the idea that the body causes the mind, that the mind causes the body. And then in the second section, he critiques psychoanalysis for separating consciousness from the unconscious. He thinks that he thinks that the process which creates a sentence and creates a coherent thought must be part of the ongoing consciousness itself. And one thought must transform into the next thought, and one perception must transform into the next thought. And it's not that the unconscious is creating our desires, our drives, our sentences, our phrases, our parapraxies, or our failures. Parapraxies are slips of the tongue or slips of like dreams. Dreams are supposed to reveal your unconscious desires or whatever. So Sartre critiques all that because it separates consciousness from itself. But for the phenomenologist, consciousness has to be given. And then in the last 30 pages, he goes over, and the conclusion is in here too. He goes over his own view of like phenomenology. And there's where we get this like some we get we start talking about. So he's been critiquing other views, but he's taking like one or two things from each of these thinkers. He explains why we're doing phenomenology or why, like I said, why phenomenology is better than psychology. And then he critiques James, but takes one thing from James or something. And then he critiques Janet. And he reduces Janet. Janet's a male. But there is a female author, I think Adembo, who they misgender in the translation. Like, she's a female scientist. And Tamara Dembo, not Adembo, but just Dembo. Yeah, like, I don't know if it was Sartre or the translation. Like, maybe the original was ambiguous and the translator didn't realize, but they put he. They say that Dembo does not, but Dembo grasps it, but he does not take full advantage of it. So I don't know in the history. I don't know the French. I don't have the other transcriptions, but that was an issue I noticed because in doing like the background research to see about these other figures that Sartre's working across, I noticed that they misgendered her in the. So when you're reading it, you might see that too. When we read it together, I'll point it out in the lectures. But yeah, and then we talk about the magical world. We talk about Theic consciousness, mechanical world, the magical world. There's a lot in those 30 pages, quite honestly. It's really cool. I think it's rugged, and it gives us like a quick and dirty overview of, or like kind of intro to phenomenology itself and some of Sartre's important concepts like intersubjectivity. And he basically says that when the mechanical world or the mechanistic world breaks down due to a failure of our ability to achieve some necessary goal, it's the world itself which reveals itself as magical, which is to say, going back to Spinoza, that matter has a sort of mental mind magic to it. He says that the magic is the mind crawling among things out in the world. Isn't that crazy? The mind crawling among things out in the world. And that the man is always a sorcerer to man, and the social world is primarily magical. Some really astounding phrases. And when I talk about intuitionism or, and we get to Deleuze, Immanence of Life. That's a whole other biscuit. I mean, or hoagie. I must be hungry. It's complex. Let's finish up Sartre. So Sartre, shows us some really cool key concepts from phenomenology while also pluralizing and desubjectivating consciousness and phenomenology, as well as bringing the mind out of the solipsistic individualistic perspective and into the intersubjective cogito. Nancy also, I don't remember if it's in being singular plural, it might be, but he has this phrase, the cogito each time for each one, where each turn of the world is theirs. It might be in the inoperative community. It might be in of divine places. I'm going to need to mark it down and remember it whenever. I want to spend some time really going back through Nancy again, which is why I've added him and I've put him on other reading lists too. Okay. Wow, almost an hour. There's a lot to cover in all these ideas. I'm glad we separated it from the assignment structure. What he's doing here is he's going to show the simultaneity of unity and multiplicity, which was a theme in Bergson as well, the one and the many, rationalism versus empiricism. And we saw rationalism versus empiricism. It comes up a lot in the modern and American pragmatism texts, as well as in intuitionism, but not so much in the other texts. Descartes and Spinoza are rationalists. Deleuze says he's working on like what he calls like a transcendental empiricism that includes immanence that is produced by immanence, and immanence is produced by a life. So a life is the most fundamental thing. And so just the this is Conatus, or the urge to self-preservation in Spinoza. And we don't cover it in this class, but in Bergson, there's a text called Creative Evolution, where I think he basically says that evolution itself is driven by a self-preservation life force. And if you've ever had like near-death experiences, it seems to me that life finds a way of keeping you alive. And this is some of the stuff we talk about. He does mention near-death experiences in Immanence of Life. It's really complicated. Immanence of Life is one of the first texts we cover in 1304, World Religions, because transcendence versus immanence is a key concept when thinking about religion. So I make a big deal to really cover it. But most of the history of philosophy is transcendent, hierarchical, vertical, dominant, analytic. But intuition and immanence are horizontal, they're collaborative, cooperative. They co-create, we coexist, we co-constitute consciousness. So going back to phenomenology, consciousness isn't just something my brain constitutes. It is something the world constitutes with myself. The brain doesn't even matter. Like, that's probably maybe the biggest confusion about phenomenology. The brain matters as a site of organization and memory and behavior. But I don't know that it matters at a level of phenomena and the hard problem of consciousness. Just, I think for Dewey in, I mean, for Dewey and Whitehead, it doesn't. Dewey praises Whitehead's giving everything experience. And the way that Whitehead gives everything experience is to say that our experience of things is a second order grasping of that thing. So my experience of this yellow is not to say that my brain synthesizes the yellow that is not present except as light form, light waves in the object. No, it's to say that it actually is present in the object. And it expresses itself to me, and I grasp it. They organize a diverse grasping of. Anyway, in being singular plural, I kind of jumped ahead to Immanence, a life. In Zones of Immanence, he's talking about kind of like translation and the one and the many, more specifically, not so much transcendence, but and not so much near-death experiences or a life. He hasn't quite figured out a life yet. It's terrible saying that because a life is the last thing he wrote before committing. He got very sick and he took a euthanasia route when it became impossible to sustain himself. He was old. Deleuze didn't travel very much. It's really lovely to see some pictures of him where he looks like wild-eyed. I think he might be one of my favorite just people in philosophy because, and if you read some of his lectures, like in one lecture, he goes, "I really hope you haven't given up on your reading yet." And the students go, "No, we haven't." And he goes, "Good. I know it's tough, but I really want you to push through." And so it's like, oh my gosh. Yeah, thanks, bud. Yeah, it's tough. You wrote a lot and you're a smart dude. It's surprising for him to be so brilliant and yet so friendly, if that makes sense. And so I really appreciate that about him and just seeing pictures of him. He looks like he was so fun. He looks like he was just kind of wild-eyed. He said about Spinoza that unlike any other, no m more so than any other philosopher, Deleuze says that Spinoza makes one, gives one the feeling of being forced to mount a witch's broom. Which I just think like Spinoza does that. Yeah, Spinoza has crazy ideas, hits them hard from the jump, and then keeps hitting them hard. And I try to do that too. I really hope that it feels like we're on a witch's broom with this class. So, with being singular plural, I'll get to it later. I've got a lot of things to do this spring semester. I'll be presenting, like I said, at the Central APA and the Pacific APA. Hopefully doing a PhD interview. Hopefully presenting a few other conferences, building some other lectures out. Anyway, but if that's all the case, then I should get to this one really quickly, because I have so many other things to do anyway. Being singular plural, we're just going to cover like the first few passages. Nancy has a kind of scattered way of writing where he is kind of circular, but maybe every 3 to 5 or 3 to 7 pages, he'll switch sections. So his sections are really short and they have subtitles. They don't really follow code like linear argumentation. They're very usually very explosive. And actually, one of the things he says in the preface is that he's writing philosophy speaking to itself. So he claims, not Jean-Luc Nancy claims that in writing being singular plural, which was translated by one of my mentors, I think she was still in graduate school when she did it, but she's also a very impressive figure. Anyway, Nancy argues that he is almost like addressing an addressless. I forget exactly how he says it. I don't have it. No, I don't have it over here with me. I have two other Nancy books here with me. But maybe it helps to think of another phrase. So, in Listening, a book by Jean-Luc Nancy, he says that listening is musical when it is music that listens to itself, returns to itself, finds itself resonating with itself. And he thinks that basically going back to those kind of perturbation chambers of sensory experience where we resonate with phenomena that are already present in the world, that's basically what he's talking about, it seems. And so, if at some point, then this body starts to do that, it may not be Professor Hill speaking or you speaking. And that's what Nancy says. So, it's perhaps best to just pull up the exact quote. This text does not disguise its ambition of redoing the whole of first philosophy by giving the singular plural of being as its foundation. So instead of like the Cogito, for example. This, however, is not my ambition, but rather the necessity of the thing itself and of our history. At the very least, I hope to make this necessity felt. At the same time, apart from the fact that I do not have the strength to deliver the treatise of the singular plural essence of being, the form of the ontological treatise ceases to be appropriate as soon as the singular of being itself, and therefore also of ontology, is in question. This is nothing new. So Nietzsche, or sorry, he says Nietzsche, though, so I was thinking of it. Nancy is, I guess we call him explosive, or we say that he's nonlinear or hard to wrangle, because much like phenomenology, he has these fleeting eidetics which we can grasp and follow, and they make perfect sense, but they're so specific at each step of the way that it's almost impossible to try to present them all coherently necessarily, at least while retaining their diversity. That's one of the things in the sentiment of rationality that James talks about, is the two extremes or two kind of key tenets that we expect of truth, is that it be precise but also simple. And those are at odds with each other. The more simple it is and intelligible and clear it is, or the more one it becomes, the less many it becomes, the more specific to the uniqueness of the particular it is, then the less clear and intelligible it becomes. So it's kind of the same tension here, but we can lean into eidetics to trust that we don't have to, call into question and test necessarily every sentence. As long as it makes sense when we pass along it, we can keep moving. Okay. That should be, and then you have the final on Sartre, Nancy, and Deleuze. I think Sartre's the easiest. You have multiple prompts to choose between multiple chapters. If you do the Sartre text, I prefer that you maybe give me some context about the other chapters in the intro or conclusion, but focus the body on the prompt I give you and don't mix prompts still. When it comes that late in the semester, if you get into the exam and you've prepared a structure for the entire text, try to rework it, but it may not be a big deal to me, but really stick to the prompts. There's a prompt for the introduction, there's a prompt for the classic theories, there's a prompt. I might have mixed the prompt for the second, first and second one. I can't remember exactly. But the point is, there's not just one prompt for Sartre, and you can't just restate the text kind of generically at this bigger scale without following the prompt. Whereas with Dewey, actually, I let you pick from a long list of things because I think that Dewey is far more integrated with their presentation. And whether it's chapter one or chapter three, they're working with the same ideas. But Sartre's fairly linear, it seems. And then Nancy is kind of explosive. And Deleuze is esoteric, I think, for lack of a better word. Kind of existential. I don't know. Maybe religious. Feels kind of religious too. And then, yeah, you'll have breaks. Check the dates down here. Exams are due week one for the syllabus quiz and practicing respondus. And then you have the five unit exams. Again, let's go back and do the read the overview of the class. So I've given you all the readings and kind of talked about them. This course surveys writings across the historical traditions. Sartre's 1939, I believe. So for the modern period, or for the continental philosophy period, that says 1939 to 1995. And I believe Being Singular Plural and Immanence Alive were both published in 1995. Okay. And like I said before, American Pragmatism goes 1904 to 1934. Modern is 18, or sorry, 1641 to 1853, even though really it probably stops around 1800. But in our case, I brought Mill in, so it's another 53. Kant is like 1785, 1784. Grounding is 85, I believe, and Answer to the Question is 84. Or maybe it's 82 and 83. The dates are under my annotations on my website. So Kant is 1784, and then, yeah, the grounding is 85. Okay. And Mitsumi is recent. Mitsumi is 24, 2015, I think. But Spinoza is like 1670. So I consider them part of the modern unit. Here. Spinoza ethics, data publication. I need to update that. Minus AI. 1677. So he sent his desk. Part of his will said that his desk with a lock on it and the drawers locked was to be sent to his publisher. And then his publisher was the only one who could access the text. It might have been destroyed or burned if somebody else had gotten to it first, because it's kind of heretical. It was heretical for his culture at the time. And it's brilliant. It's a work of genius. One of the most true things ever written. I still need to study it. I guess another thing I'll say is that I got some student feedback that it was like, why would you want to learn from somebody who hasn't read the things? Oh, and the answer is I have read some of the things and I understand them. And there's a ton of things to read. And I've read a lot of things and I understand a lot of things. Sorry, I didn't mean just some of those comments were rude for how much work I put into the course. Like when I say I haven't read, all of Spinoza's ethics, it's like a 300-page book. And then I'm teaching you 20 other 300-page, 200, 300-page books. I think also, perhaps more importantly, I don't believe in the kind of philosophy that comes from books. I believe in life experience. And growing and developing the ability to think well, the ability to have spiritual convictions and intuitions. I don't believe in depositing containers of knowledge into my students. So I think I would be a worse person if I, for example, didn't work in a restaurant in New York, but had read instead. Like I got different kinds of life-changing experience by teaching fourth grade rather than reading some certain books. So content knowledge is important to me, obviously, but I've really pursued specific research interests and reflected on specific research interests. Alfred North Whitehead, for example, said that he didn't have time to prove his own work for mistakes or to really read the contemporary philosophers because he wouldn't have time to think for himself with new ideas and then to write and communicate those new ideas. So philosophy is not regurgitating a history of things. I like that method because it's very defensible. If you can say, no, this is what the text says, then you have a backbone of history to rely on and help you out in making your claims. But don't get it twisted. It's not necessary to, I mean, we're focusing specifically on a set of primary sources. I don't expect you to read anything else. Okay. I was going to change the annotations, the bibliography. Specifically, Spinoza needed. And sorry, I'm like super grateful to have students. Every new semester, I'm grateful for a new set of students and another. chance to nest and welcome them. I put a lot of effort and attention and care into a complex class and making it accessible, not to make it more advanced than it needs to be. And there were just one student. There was like, no, there wasn't just one student. It seemed like a handful of students each had a different complaint about one aspect of the class. And you can't please everybody, but I wish they understood and enjoyed and appreciated the intention. And I think if I was frustrated, it was just kind of hurt. And that's not of any relevance to my new students, except I hope you aren't taking it this way already. Okay, so cool stuff, fun stuff. It's super late, I'm tired. So I wanted to, sorry, I got distracted because I wanted to go back down and cover the dates of those authors since that's part of the syllabus quiz. This course surveys writings across the historical traditions of ancient philosophy, modern philosophy, American pragmatism, and 20th century continental philosophy. Philosophers include Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Descartes, Spinoza, Kant, Mill, Bergson, James, Dewey, Sartre, Deleuze, Nancy, and Mizumi. And notice here that I put that list of philosophers in chronological order. Bergson comes in the middle because comes in between Mill and James because 1903 is that's in between their dates. But in terms of when we read them, Bergson is first. And I also didn't list intuitionism. Themes include eidetic intuition, metaphysics, normative metaethics. So normative meaning the like what you ought to do. Metaphysics is everything that physics can't explain, but still like you want to know about, like freedom, cause and effect, fundamental substances, the nature of being, what does it mean to exist, the meaning of life, that kind of stuff. Eidetic intuition is how you can know, I think things are true. So we don't, I don't think I use the word epistemology, but that's how we address epistemology in this class, aside from skepticism and rationalism and empiricism. Virtue in the Greek is arete for excellence. And so different tools have different functions and they'll have different excellencies. So the arete or virtue of a potato peeler is different from the arete or virtue of a bread knife. They have different functions. They would be built differently. The arete or virtue of a good toaster is different from the arete or virtue of a good kettle. Like, I'm not going to put toast in a kettle and I'm not going to put water in a toaster. They have different excellencies or aretes because they have different virtues. And so virtue is related to the function or purpose on design. In ancient philosophy, they thought that purpose was part of nature. So Aristotle thought that you could discern telos or intelligent design or purposes in the way that animals were made. But then evolution shows that this isn't true, or that there's a natural explanation to why animals are the way they are in relation to nature's needs. And Dewey basically explains that, kind of following up on this, he says we get it backwards. Since we mold our means end reasoning or goal-oriented reasoning on nature's cause and effect, we assume that it is nature who must be built with us, built like us. So there must be some divine design inside of nature itself, because we have design in what we do, but really we're misunderstanding the direction where our design is a mimicking of nature's cause and effect. But yeah, that's going back to like purpose or arete in ancient philosophy. That's where virtue comes from. And then that's virtue ethics, deontology or rule-based or law-based, normative ethics, utilitarianism, which is the first form of consequentialism, where you're maximizing utility. Consequentialism is any theory of justice that seeks to maximize some good thing or set of things. It can be freedom or in utilitarianism, it's pleasure in the absence of pain spread over an indiscriminate group of people. But that's one of the problems with utilitarianism is that it's insensitive to the group of people that it's spread over, and it's hard to create minimum thresholds in a sort of elegant way. It's insensitive to its results, or it's insensitive to the distribution. Like where things end up going on the whole doesn't really matter. And so you might have an agent that gets deprived of life, like killed by a mob that once has a massive bloodlust and would take pleasure in it. I guess I'd say that I'm working on a form of labor or a form of value theory that sees nurturing mutual well-being as the thing to maximize. And so satisfying a bloodlust wouldn't be a comprehensible form of well-being that could be valuable to a community because it wouldn't sustain life. The good life, different conceptions of it, what it means. Rationalism, it's kind of associated with the one and with idealism, Plato, Descartes. Empiricism, sorry, I was thinking about something. Empiricism is learning through experience or through observation. They claim that empiricists claim that we're a blank slate, and we come across new data that kind of fills us up like a vessel. Maybe something like the phenomena matrix that I was talking about with Nancy and resonance. Idealism is the theory that everything is the mind. Materialism is the theory that everything is like physical and matter. Dualism is that there are two fundamental substances, like maybe there's mind and matter. Monism is there's just one substance. So, pluralism is the theory, well, that there are multiple true perspectives, I guess. And the way that James talks about it is like, if he notices that an environment has been destroyed by people cutting down trees, and he meets the people who cut down the trees and he sees their cabins, he might go from, pluralistically speaking, he might go from his first conviction that it was a destruction of the environment to seeing it from their perspective, that it was a triumph over harsh, and austere conditions of non-survival, that they survived. And so it's a sort of perspectivism, or that, truth depends on the perspective. That's part of what James's genetic theory means. But pluralism also involves like there being, affect theory would create distinct necessary perceptions or interpretations unique to what else you've been through. Even if you and I have the same stimuli, we'll interpret that experience differently or call to mind different past experiences based on what else we've already learned or not learned or experienced or collected or what have you, however you want to call it. That's pluralism too, is a sort of perspective difference and maybe egalitarianism, but it's epistemic, ontological, metaphysical, metaethical, political. Okay. Enlightenment is, in Kant's sense, is the courage to use your own reason and make your mistakes and fail. We don't really cover critiques of enlightenment, but like the Horkheimer and Adorno in the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory and Dialectic of Enlightenment critique that science and enlightenment are just another name for myth these days, and we've traded beliefs in one thing for beliefs in another, but we still don't really have the right kind of justification or eidetics behind them. They just kind of taken the place and the function of what myth and religion used to do. Okay, skepticism in Descartes is a rational holding at bay. It's using rational reasons to hold at bay some belief about the world. And it's kind of related to the phenomenological reduction, where you're bracketing the world, meaning you're holding it at bay a little bit to see what is necessary about the thing you're thinking about. And you're also bracketing, making that world part of you. Okay. But you're also making yourself part of the world. Pragmatism, we covered that already down below. Basically, just that, well, it's a whole school, it's a whole tradition, has multiple components to it. And different authors do it differently. Aesthetics, or a theory of beauty. So there's two components of value theory. There's ethics and aesthetics. One is related to what people deserve, and I guess one is related to what objects deserve. It's a weird distinction, like the good versus the beautiful. Certain philosophers put them together. James says that truth is one is a subspecies of the good. So the reason the genetic theory of truth is unique to each person is because it's how that person survives. It's what is good for that person, and only that person alone. So it's unique to each person. Anyway, aesthetics is about beauty, not goodness or truth. But Plato, for example, says that the good is more true, perfect, and beautiful than anything else in contemplation. So there's a unity to all of it. But in recent, academia, a lot of I think, like Dewey thinks, that they separate themselves away from each other too much. He talks about a compartmentalization that is not organization, but a decay because they're in separate silos. But really, organization is to be in harmony with your different rhythms and to bring it all into one surging, big harmony. Existentialism, that's when we get to Sartre. So instead of essence coming first and telos and arete and purpose coming first, we're just thrown. We just exist. And then we have to determine through our actions what is the right and just thing for us to do. That doesn't mean that we don't have eidetic intuition or that there aren't essences that we can grasp or come to. It just means that we are responsible for determining them for ourselves through. He's kind of a Kantian Sartre. He thinks we don't really cover it. It's in Existentialism as a Humanism, which is a really short text. It's another one that I would consider covering given the time to add a lecture here or there. But he says that our actions legislate the appropriate action for everyone after us. So whatever I do, I take up as an appropriate action, kind of like the opposite direction of Kant. Whereas Kant says you should only do what you wish everyone to do, Sartre points out that once you've done it, everyone else has been legislated to do it, to be able to do it. I don't know if you can unring those bells for Sartre. Phenomenology, again, looking at the phenomena instead of the thing behind the phenomena, seeing the truth or the justification for things in their givenness and their surface experiencing. That eidetic intuition. Transcendence, meaning a set of discrete objects that have to overcome their independence and cross boundaries to transcend and come into contact, usually with a dualist or individualistic perspective. and usually with some kind of god or ultimate source of being as dominating and being the authority on what is right and good, versus immanence as a self-generating principle of life, where immanence is only immanent to itself. It is the kind of local identity of all of expanded space. So the kind of interiority of everything creates its exteriority, and it's all expressing outward in fluid fields. Versus transcendence being like discrete containers that have to cross outside of their containerness, right? So we have sort of like sharp edges and fuzzy zones. And this holds true in the history of philosophy when philosophers talk about transcendence and immanence. I think that's it, guys. The guiding questions for this, as of right now, are at 11 pages. So I really hope you enjoy it. I might add a few more things if I can. Like, I know I wanted to expand the Spinoza lecture series to include also some stuff on Deleuze, Benjamin, and myself, because I've published something on, excuse me, on Benjamin Adorno and Spinoza when I was an undergrad, right out of undergrad. It was in an undergrad journal. And then recording Nancy and looking at the hours and seeing if there's weeks to add a few more hours on, like, anyway. But I think there's like a coherence, I think there's an aesthetic experience across these different readings and across these different units between intuitionism kind of launching you into intuition, which is how I think you should do philosophy, versus analysis, which I think is a problematic pitfall that most people go into. And it's repeated in the cave, where Plato makes the distinction between being itself versus appearances, or truth itself versus looking true, or being good versus looking good. Philosophers historically are more concerned with being good than looking good. In the Ring of Gyges, for example, perfect justice is exemplified by somebody who everyone thinks is a bad person, but always does things, does the right thing for the right reasons, and is always misunderstood. That's why it's perfect, because there are no outer rewards, is what Gyges, or sorry, Glaucon and Socrates are discussing. I think specifically it is Glaucon who presents that position, if I remember correctly. It's been a few months. Anyway, guys. Oh, and you know, Dewey says that aesthetic experience must be loving. Sophia, stop. Stop.
Stop. No. Stop.
She scratches the screen couch. The screen couch I got from my ex that went missing and passed away. And I tried to take really good care of it, but she loves it. She reminds me of the ex because she showed up at the same time she went missing. But anyway, she scratches the crap out of it. Dewey says that for an object to be, for a work of art to be aesthetic, it must be made lovingly, which means that there must be some kind of aesthetic experience that the creator had, was having actively, and had in mind to reproduce through the work, and was paying attention to the work to see how it came out, was looking at their painting or their sculpture to see if it matched their vision, was opening themselves up to actually being authentically influenced by the work they were creating rather than being stuck in their head. Anyway, there must be some kind of like divine experience or passionate experience in the work of art for Dewey, for aesthetic experience. And I hope that you can start Philosophy 1301 with a fairly clear picture of how all the different units work together and what the fun stuff is in each one. I think that units 1, 4, and 5 are the most fun, but 2 and 3, ancient and modern, have classics that are really important. They're hard to skip past. You kind of just expect to cover them, and they help you understand or critique. They help you understand the other stuff that I think is really fun, and they help you crit like the stuff that I think is really fun is a good critique of them. So they serve as like a contrast in my anyway. We're at 90 minutes. And it's very late. I'm going to upload these videos, upload the audios, launch them, make sure all my students this semester, spring 26, know about them. And yeah, good luck on your syllabus quiz, your essay exam, all the specific content. So there's the aesthetic critique, there's the radical philosophy hour with Professor Casey, there's a lockdown practice quiz that's pretty standard. Icebreakers and syllabus quiz are standard. Exit tickets and annotations are standard. And then your timed essay exams for each unit are also standard. Go back and check out the workflows video if any of that's unclear. We covered some of the main ideas, some of the traditions. So the course description has the four traditions we're drawing from. Intuitionism is grouped in with 20th century continental. And James is also sometimes grouped in with 20th century continental. In the lecture series on James, I do an introduction that's not written by James. When you're writing your essay, please make sure that the notes that you're using and drawing from were about what pragmatism means, not from that introduction. AI is still not permitted. We cover Aristotle, Nicomachean Ethics, excerpts from books 1, 2, and 8, Bergson, Henri, Introduction to Metaphysics, G.S. Deleuze, Immanence of Life, and Zones of Immanence, René Descartes, Meditations on First Philosophy, the First, Second, and Third Meditations, John Dewey, Art as Experience, chapters 1 through 3, William James, What Pragmatism Means, and then also an introduction in William James's Selected Writings written by G.H. Byrd. I believe Graham Byrd. Immanuel Kant, an answer to the question, what is enlightenment? And Immanuel Kant's grounding for the metaphysics of morals, preface and first section. Brian Mitsumi's Politics of Affect, preface and excerpt from chapter one. And John Stuart Mill's Utilitarianism, chapters one through two. Jean-Luc, we also cover a lot of stuff that's not in that primary source from just what I think is. Are other important aspects of utilitarianism to critique. Jean-Luc Nancy, Being Singular Plural, excerpts from the first 20 pages or so. Plato's Apology, which is written from the voice of Socrates, but in Plato's eloquent writing. Plato's Republic, excerpts from books 1, 2, and 4 are one lesson, and then excerpts from books 6 and 7 are a second lesson the next week. Jean-Paul Sartre's Sketch for a Theory of the Emotions. And then Baruch Spinoza's, that's in its entirety, the sketch. And then Baruch Spinoza's Ethics, a short excerpt from part three. All right, guys. Yeah, your aesthetic critique is due in the Dewey section a week before the essay exam. And your short response to the Radical Philosophy Hour with Professor Casey is due in the second unit. So the aesthetic critique was due in the unit four, the Dewey unit, and the short response is due in unit two, the ancient philosophy unit. Historically, I recorded it between recording the Republic and Nicomachean Ethics. So that's just kind of, it fits pretty well with where I was thinking, and students can follow along pretty easily. If you have any questions about any of this, just let me know. Hopefully, doing this overview like this will make all of the information easy to follow and very straightforward throughout the semester. So, I really appreciate you for being here. And I hope you don't find it overwhelming or like I'm repeating myself or saying too much. I think that repeating myself will help you remember it. And it shouldn't be contradictory with the stuff that comes later. So, if I forget anything, please let me know and I can try to clear it up in an announcement or something. Or if I ever have to remake this video one day, then having students tell me for here and there, like, hey, this helped, hey, this didn't help, that's useful for me to learn from. So thank you so much. And let me know if you have questions. And I hope you, like I said, I hope you enjoy learning philosophy. I really chose these things out of conviction, because I care. And I think that they're cool and interesting and important meta-ethically to how we live our lives. So remember in your essay exam to include a paragraph towards the end where you talk about what we should change, either in our own lives or socially, based on the lessons we learn from these primary sources. Bye, guys. Be safe and take care of each other. Good luck. Let me know if you need anything. Thanks for being here.